future is now. And welcome to the SVK Crypto Podcast. 15 minutes of crypto fame.
My name is Charles Story. I will be your host for the next 15 minutes. We're coming live from the city of London, Shoreditch. So let's get down to business. Today's show is going to have a slightly different format. We have what I think is one of the best interviews we have done in the show's 240 episode history. We have Mr. Timothy Lewis on the show today. Timothy brings us up to speed with his take and his view from his experiences from being at the very start of the revolution that is crypto and blockchain. Timothy is a venture partner at DNA. He's also a founder of the block producer Liberty Block and his new venture, Ikigai Asset Management. I hope that you enjoy the show as much as myself and Tim did making it. So with that in mind, let's get down to business and jump into the interview. So on today's show, we have Timothy Lewis. Timothy has an array of different things he's been doing. He is the founder of Liberty Block. He's a venture partner at DNA, and he's also founder at Ikigai Asset Management. Timothy, how's it going?
Fantastically well, Charles. Fantastically well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, dude. And where in the world are you today? Because I know you're pretty decentralized in your travel. You're everywhere, dude. You're everywhere. Where are you at the minute?
Los Angeles, California. Happy to be back home a little bit. I'd like to spend at least 4 or 5 months a year here. So happy to be back. We got a lot of things going on. San Francisco Blockchain Week. After this call, I'm going to go head up to San Francisco for a night and then back down here to finish up BlockCon tomorrow in Santa Monica.
Wow. Well, listen, what I want to do with this podcast is really get an understanding of yourself, where you've come from, your views, your beliefs, and where you are now, because you've got a very impressive story. So I think the way to start this is at the beginning. So where did it all begin? Did it begin after school? When did you first get into crypto? When did you first hear about it? I think that's the best way to begin.
You know, I'm going to bring it back to when I first got into computers. I was a late 70s baby, Generation Xennial, and my father bought me a computer when I was 4 years old. Hung out with a bunch of sisters all the time. They played with dolls I got on the computers. I started working on BBSs and when I was about 6 or 7. Back then, things were a little bit different. My first modem was a 1200 baud modem that was actually tipped to ring, where you actually had to put the receiver end of the handset onto the modem to be able to dial in, dial out. I was absolutely hooked. Trying to find different ways, different finding materials, finding information was what that name of the game was all about. And running a BBS was just an immense amount of fun for a 7-year-old farm boy. So growing up outside of Cincinnati, growing up in Lebanon, Ohio, there weren't many people to talk to near the farmlands. So finding communication methods with friends who had information you wanted was what it became all about. You know, moving on from there, really my first introduction to cryptography was when friends of mine and I started communicating on other networks. You know, you had all the news groups and you had IRC, but everyone started using PGP. And that's
and what year was that?
This is 1990, 1991, somewhere near there. We started getting into all the communication networks. So cryptography was labeled as a munition in the United States up until late 92, I believe. So a lot of my friends, since we would talk about sensitive subjects, and I grew up really on the, you know, black hat, gray hat side of systems engineering and development. So a lot of the friends that I spoke with were very international. The best information would come from friends of mine in Berlin and in Tokyo. So, you know, hearing about these different communication methods, knowing that we could have privacy in our communications however we wanted them, was interesting to me. So I started learning more about cryptography. It was really a hot subject at the time because you literally could not send information about cryptography. Exporting cryptographic methods was against the law. So, you know, it kind of began this lifetime for me of what is right, what is wrong, and who tells me, right? So understanding that at a young age, and I'm starting to consume material at that age that was interesting. A number of the different manifestos that went around, and one of them was the Cypherpunk Manifesto. So getting in tune with that at an early age was important for me. I spent my career, most of my career in IT as a developer, as a network architect, as a security architect, as a data center architect, working for various government agencies, various banks. I spent a lot of time doing data expediency, and then also healthcare organizations. But along that way, you know, the 90s were a great time for finding and sharing information. And at that time, it was super new. So we were trying to find the most radical ideas, the most radical information that would let information be free. And so that kind of came, that kind of became a theme for my life, making sure that other people had the same access to the freedom of information that I felt that I had, because I felt that that was, that was really freedom. You know, growing up on a farm, without the communication networks, I would not have been able to go find and be able to go educate myself in the way that I did. So I wanted to make sure that other people, regardless of religion or nationality or location, could have information to that same access. So we recognized early on that cryptography was that method. So setting up different styles of VPN mesh networks and setting up different styles of communication outlets for people became part of my fight.
So what age were you around this kind of time?
I mean, 1990, I was 12 years old. Don't want to age myself there, young Charles, but you know, I've led this for a long time.
So with that in mind, what was your ambitions as a youngster when you're 12 years old? What did you want to do at that stage? Like, what was your, not necessarily career ambitions, but what do you want to accomplish?
You know, I don't know if I had much other than, I was really into financial technology. I really got into trading stock when I was a young teenager with my grandfather. But I knew it, the system was kind of broken. I knew I wanted to amass some sort of wealth because I wanted to help people. But I didn't really have a career, something in line. You know, at the time, I think that I knew I did not want to have a 9-to-5. I knew I did not want to have a right. job. That was a working for someone else. So entrepreneurship back then also was kind of a newer subject. So reading, you know, I think in high school, my two book reports in high school were both from the Bill Gates books, Business at the Speed of Thought and The Road Ahead. But really kind of trying to figure out, knowing that if you had the ability to program, knowing that if you had the ability to develop, you really could write your own future. So just really trying to figure out what methods and what I could do. But at the time, you know, under 18 years old, I was definitely on the edge of the law when it came to what type of information, what type of things, you know, how I was acquiring money. You know, those were different things that I did. But I had great mentors and making sure that I was, you know, at 18, I changed a lot of things in my life just to make sure that this was pre-9/11 days, you know, making sure that the machines that I was accessing were done so with permission. And then I got on the other side to try to do penetration testing and different things in security.
So who were some of the mentors that kind of inspired you around that kind of time point?
You know,
who were your idols?
Right. So Larry Lessig, when he started popping up and the information that he had been releasing through the Chicago School of Management, I think it is. Larry Lessig is one of the leaders of the Electronics Frontier Foundation. So when I started reading about the Electronics Frontier Foundation, mid-90s is when it just really all popped. And I knew that there were other people that were really guiding this. But for me personally, on the as an engineer, there were great communities. You know, you had 2,600 communities. You had these local communities that you could connect to. You would actually go to meetups. You would get out. If anyone in your audience has heard of the 2600 Hacker Quarterly, that's what everything was all about. You know, before that, there was also Blacklisted 911. These were these quarterly magazines that would also have local classifieds, and so you could find the other digital misfits in your area. And you would go meet up. So I had some amazing older guys that were incredible engineers. that kind of showed me the ropes. And, you know, we had these different organizations, especially during the early 90s, where you had these different style of currying groups, routing groups, different ways of transferring and holding information that were kind of done in hierarchical manners, and all the where scene and all of the different zero-day scenes that you found really good mentors in, and I connected with some of the best. So I'll leave their names off this because a lot of times, you know, you don't want to be associated with that, but really awesome guys. 2600 Magazine, the old meetups back then were fantastic. But on a broader scope, Larry Lessig, when it came to understanding information freedom.
So what happened between, you know, the late 90s and 2008? Like, what was, so you're on the, you're understanding cryptography as the actual form it was, the structure, the development behind that. So what took place between those years before you started buying into Bitcoin, which we'll get into in a second? Were you doubling down, or did you kind of veer into a different path and really started a career? Like, what was happening between those times?
Yeah, so when I was 18, I decided that I'd throw it all into. I had been working at that time for different developments and different network engineering and architecture tasks, but I decided to go up to New York. I got my Series 7. It was a wild time, 1996. Technology, you know, this is the dot-com era number one. I figured I'm going to get myself to New York and try to figure out how to make some money, knowing what are the right technologies to get into. So I moved to New York, spent about 2.5 years picking stocks, learning how to have communication, learning better phone skills, mannerisms, and spent about 2.5 years diving deep into technology. You know, I left before the crash. I left because I had a personal crash. I mean, I went from a farm to living in New York City, driving around a boss of mine's Ferrari and going up to the Hamptons on the weekends. And it was just a little bit too much, I think, for myself at a young age. And so I spent a couple years there, jumped back, tried to go to college for a little bit, felt that that's what I needed, really just spent about a year partying. You know, American college is can be a wild time. A lot of fun. Charles, you would have loved it. We would have really enjoyed ourselves there. But I decided I'd get out. I got an opportunity to go work up in Chicago for a really large bank. It was a really large merger that was about to go on in the FX market. And I got tapped to come up and help architect that. So left Columbus, Ohio, went to Chicago, and started working for the banks. So it was during that time, the bank I worked for, the parent bank was Societe Generale, which is a French bank. And along that line, that line up from 2005, 6, 7, as we started getting into the crash, all of my friends who were in other banks that we, you know, if you have the data architecture community in a city and in these different location. So you know, we were running the data centers in Secaucus, New Jersey, in south side of Chicago, Cermak in Chicago, for CME, CBOE, CBOT, New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, interstitial access, working on data expediency. It's a small crew that's doing this. So you know everybody else that's going to be in the racks and in the cages doing the work. And around that time, everything started to dry up because most of the banks had lost such a substantial amount of money and weren't doing the infrastructure work that that they had been doing previously. But Societe Generale stayed out of it. They didn't get into any of those loans that a lot of the American banks did. So we still had money. We were still working. No one else was there. It ended up being, you know, a time where we're setting up a tons of, you know, disaster recovery, and we are implementing this merger still. So that all is going on, but we had a lot of extra free time, which will allow us to spend a lot more time on different forums, on different, you know, areas of the internet. You know, so friend of mine during this, friend of mine, Patrick Murphy, actually is a coworker of mine, introduced us to Bitcoin, somewhere around April of 2009.
What year was that? 2009. Wow. Early doors. So what price did you buy it at?
There was no price to buy it at during that time. You are running desktops first to figure out whether you could run nodes. And then we ran some, DR equipment throwing these things up. It was really experimentation at the time. No one knew that that was going to have any value. There's nothing I would change about that. A lot of the equipment that we ran to be doing testing on, that was at the time, you're getting 50 Bitcoin rewards on turning blocks from CPUs from desktop machines, but you didn't know that that's going to have any value. Wow. Right. So a lot of those machines were, taken down, broken down. I remember specifically there was a particular DR facility that we shut down in late 2009 that had been running some nodes, and we just shut it down. And we had forgotten that we had put it on there. And then we decided, oh, hey, should we boot that back up and go grab that? We just decided it wasn't worth the time. You know, so it was one of those things that no one really anticipated this having value. It was about a year later, there was a Slashdot article that really kind of excited the community, right? And that's really kind of when you got back in. Now, we were doing one of the largest mergers in, it was a FEMAT Calion merger. And so we had a lot of other things on our mind. When we started to notice the price creep up, we were really upset at ourselves. And then it shot back down to from 30 to $1. And we thought to ourselves that this is just not gonna last. The attack of the alts was starting. So all of the altcoins that started to come in and provide no additional value, but provide a lot of question and noise to the validity of the network were coming. So in that, I was getting paid well in my job, and I really wasn't thinking that this was going to be such a radical shift in technology.
So you were mining Bitcoin while working at Société Générale.
I'm not going to say that on tape. But I think I just said that.
Okay.
It's all good. Yeah. Hopefully they won't come knocking. It was one of those situations where we have, you have DR facilities. You have massive amounts of compute power. This was before cloud computing, right? So, but when it hit mainstream, right, especially in the financial institutions, they were running all of their own equipment. You had to run massive data centers in different disparate parts of the world to make sure that if there was an attack on Chicago, for example, or an attack on Secaucus, New Jersey, that you wouldn't skip a beat in your financial transactions. So there was a lot of extra processing power to go around at the time.
So when did you decide to focus your career, your energy, your enthusiasm into crypto? When would that change happen? And what year?
I would say I'm a security engineer. So into cryptography has been pretty much my whole life, but into the cryptographic assets and understanding them as such probably came in 2013, 2014. So that was when we started hearing. I had moved from Chicago to Los Angeles in late 2012. And there was some excitement going around. My now good friend, Brock Pierce, had been going around and going to these metal meetings, these men group meetings, and talking about different things like Ethereum. But prior to that, Omni, MasterCoin, and trying to understand that these didn't just have to be simple ledgers, that they could be semi-Turing complete programmatic blockchains or semi-Turing complete programmatic Byzantine fault tolerant distributed ledgers. And that's what became interesting to me. Once we started realizing that and I started going in deeper into the possibilities, then it was just lights on. Then it was the technology was going to catch up, and the stuff was the most exciting thing I had ever I knew I was going to ever experience. And then we hit the massive massive bear market, right? So it was just like one of the I was excited. Why isn't it? I'm posting on this stuff on social media. I'm telling all my friends, like, you got to understand, like, Ethereum is going to be crazy, and no one else was listening. I kind of famously amongst my circle of friends, one of my best friends, we were, this is as late as 2014, early 2015. We had gone out to a dinner with one of his now wife, and we were sitting there, and she's a financial professional, and we were talking about financial instruments, and I am just blabbering about this Ethereum stuff and how amazing it was going to be to change everything. And this was, I think, after Homestead had been launched. There was some trading of this going on. It's definitely sub a dollar. She just wouldn't buy into it, wouldn't believe it, couldn't be real. And so, it's one of those things where I just told her, "Well, I'm all in. I think you're wrong. We had a little spat, and 2.5 years later, now she's inviting me up to her office in San Jose to talk to all her clients about crypto assets. So we know who was right on that one.
That's hilarious, dude. That's hilarious. But I know you were a big part, along with, as you mentioned, Brock Pierce, in building the LA community, which was one of the strongest communities at the time, one of the first to be built as well. How did you guys like grow that community? Because that was, I remember hearing about it from here in London, that, you know, that was one of the first communities for crypto.
Yeah. So LA just became a great spot. I mean, it was San Francisco sometimes gets too much into their own things, and whether it have been probably AI, everyone has been really most interested in, and you know, it's brilliant, a lot of brilliant people, a lot of interesting VCs, but a lot of the VCs were just, you know, follow on bros. Trying to create new instruments and trying to be able to really Brock and the idea from the BitAngels group, David Johnson and Michael Turpin, of being able to tokenize assets and being able to tokenize ownership. That was just such a great breakthrough. And I think that since it had kind of come from people who lived around here, and they everyone really started to talk about and realize the possibilities, that's why it came from, you know, that's why it kind of spread out of here. It's easiest because everyone's hanging around talking about it. You know, we had these little syndicates where people were getting together and talking about, you know, the shared ownership of these things and signifying that via crypto assets. So the community really got into the idea, and some of the first things had launched and been successful in the way that they were raising capital. And so it just became kind of contagious out here. Then setting up the events, you know, LA from a technology scene didn't have too much going on. You know, we had Snapchat going on, and we had a couple other interesting mobile applications, but ultimately we didn't have anything to kind of call our own or really lay claim to. And, you know, because of the shining light of Brock, and there was this, he had this hotel, I'm sorry, this penthouse that everyone would go to. We would have these weekly meetings where people would come down, entrepreneurs would come down from the Bay. And we're talking about some top-notch, like founders with literal billion-dollar exits that were coming down to get grilled by a bunch of, you know, cypherpunks. And it was awesome. So it was really, really something that was a lot of fun. Then turning that into a little bit more of social scene, inviting more people in, you know, as that started to build out, you know, LA just had a good head start on everybody. We need to make sure that that's still there. And our scene here is still thriving. We've held a couple awesome events this week. And, you know, it is really nice out here. Anyone who comes out to LA, you will recognize why people want to stay here. You know, if you're going to go toe to toe with San Francisco, I'll take LA, the weather, the women, and the weed all day.
Well, we'll get to different crypto scenes in a bit, because I know you, you've recently been to London, but we won't get into that right now. So when did you get into DNA? DNA was one of the biggest funds, and still is, arguably. When did that, how did you get into there? What was the transition?
Yeah,
what's
so
the story?
That really spun off of the syndicates. That really spun off of these penthouse group meetings, and really didn't have no one had any ties. It was all distributed networks of, at the time we were saying, distributed networks of advisors. So ultimately it was just a group of people that were coming together that got interested in these things, were listening to people as they were coming down, and then would group pool in the way that syndicates kind of did, being able to lay claim to some of the tokenized ownership, tokenized assets together. So that's kind of how it had formed. It really didn't have any structure to it until I think mid 2017. You know, but we had operations for quite a while, and the crew that was running it, I mean, everyone in that crew is, you know, years and years on with each other doing different things. So it became more of this, it broke off from being the social club syndicate where people had these interesting cryptographic digital asset, exposure to its form and function. And really it's kind of gone in a couple of different ways, but really its core is advisory. And it's been to, you know, we've seen more of these things, and the partners in this organization actually created, you know, the structure of the ICO Bradford Stevens and Brock and Bart Stevens, they created the idea of the STO as well, you know, with blockchain capital in mid-2016. So we were seeing these new ideas. A lot of the friends were, you know, creating the concepts, driving them forward and launching them. And so we kind of had an earlier look to a lot of the structure of these things because we were the first ones doing them. So we all kind of took different positions. For me, I was one of the most technical there. So I got to really kind of qualify from a technology standpoint, whether or not these things were going to potentially work. You know, you look back now at what these things were and what they might shape into being, and 99.9% of the things that have come so far are garbage. They have no, there's nothing behind them, either no utility or just no value to the world. But they were experiments. You know, you go back even further, you go back into the 2010 attack of the alt 2 year period. None of those things have value. I mean, so few of those. There were so many people popping off clones, you know, Bitcoin clones in their areas. And then, you know, honestly, from the 2014 to 2016 started this also, these, you know, the pyramid, the charlatans had started to come in as well. And for a while, it was interesting, fun, new technology breakthroughs. Then you had people coming in to abuse the system. And I've got some stories on some really crazy things that took a lot of value from a lot of, you know, people that were really, really sad. But we are here, you know, now in a time where things are shaping up. And, you know, the assets themselves, they're so varied. You know, there's so many different types of ways to use a cryptographic proof to create a unique digital signature asset, contract, code. That it's just an amazing space now. And we've got some years still to develop what this stuff is and what it's going to signify and what legal rights people have to the different things. It's an exciting time to be around. You know, we are still in such the beginning, such the early stages of what the possibilities are, that it's still super exciting. But we banded together as misfits and, you know, we still kind of ride or die in a decentralized manner. So it's been a lot of fun.
I like that a lot. With the current view on the ICO market, do you think it would be fair in saying it's dead?
God, I hate the ICOs. I do. I think that there needs to be a different way to be doing this, right? So I think most of these things are securities, like 99.9%. If you don't have a product and you don't have users, if you don't have users using your system every day, you don't have a utility. And so this was just most of the things that come out, most of them, and you're going to try to tell yourself that you're not one of them, but you know, honestly, most of these things are that. And, you know, I think there are different ways to create value without calling it an ICO, without actually doing an ICO. You know, in the EOS community, I'm very excited about the pure airdrops or the pure air grabs to drive community value. I think there are many other ways. And if we're using this as a tool for engineers to have more freedom, really to break away from what were the follow-on bro antics of the venture capitalists, vulture capitalists, then there are other methods that we can use without giving up that freedom of expression and ownership and rights that you do sometimes when you have people that come in and give you capital, might sometimes have a good network to provide you, and that's still very valuable. You know, there are some amazing VCs. But the outside of Sand Hill Road, the rest of the investors, you know, may have not had access to that. And the way that things have been abused kind of for the last 20 years, driving all the value into venture and not leaving any value at the public market stage, I think that's a bad thing for the economy as well. The ICOs themselves, it radically has to change. You know, you have to start, there's no accountability in a lot of these things. And that's what's going to be really sad. There's going to be a lot more that fail because there was absolutely no accountability. And so it's never been a good idea just to hand, you know, five engineers with the treasure $50 million and assume that they're going to build something great. Like that just doesn't work. So, you know, more creative ideas on how to hold and own, have governance on most of these things is a good idea. Now, I think that there will be these fully decentralized distributed systems that can come out and are born from in a similar manner that, you know, that Bitcoin was born from. You know, I think Ethereum, when it was first sold, that was a security, you know, and it really was. It's grown and it's matured into now a utility. But we have to look at these things and say that, you know, there needs to be some protections for the investors. And I'm not even talking about accredited investor protections, because I don't believe in those at all. I think that those are, in the United States, we deal with this accredited investor BS, and it really locks people from being able to participate. You know, if you are 18 years old and just don't happen to have $250,000 in income over the last 2 years and not $1 million in assets, but you know about the latest and greatest technology, and you've been working your ass off to become a part of a community, and you can't put in your $1,000 that you got for your high school graduation, you know, I'm calling foul. Yeah. Because you can go to Vegas and you can drop that in the slots, no problem. You know, your credit card company, you know, has no problem. Your Visa, MasterCard have no problem with you going to get a cash advance in Vegas and just spending your money betting on black. But if you cannot invest into whatever these things are, securities ideally, then I have a problem with that. So hopefully we'll get some regulation changes as these things go along as well. But now the crypto assets themselves are far from over, and there still will be different methods of creating, distributing, having network effects, and/or capitalizing. But I think that this pure should just be left in 2017.
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of the points you just mentioned. So, how did you get to EOS? What struck you about EOS? Because you've done a lot for the EOS community.
Thank you.
And you still are doing a lot for the EOS community. So what struck you to EOS? What brought you to it?
You know, I've been a big fan of Larimer. You know, I was a fan of BitShares, the idea of where it was going. His spats on Bitcoin Talk were always fun. He's a real engineer's engineer. The guy gets down there and he works. So seeing that and you know, Brock being around here, the conversations around when the Block One investments were going around were great, knowing that this was going to be something really interesting. You know, so when they announced and when I knew this was actually going to be coming together, you know, this was a group of people that I had known and knew that they were going to operate. It's a new idea. It's another experiment. I'm not a maximalist of any. I am chain agnostic. And so ultimately, I saw the potential of what this could do. I really do like the way that they spread during their sale. They did spread the users. I think they had a great way of, you know, kind of preventing this come whales take all and the ICO methods that have been kind of going on at that time. So I liked that idea. I also knew that it was going to get done. You know, like Dan has a consistent history, you know, of getting projects done, and he's getting smarter and better each time. So knowing that he was finally going to be making a full-blown, you know, operating system for these semi-turn complete networks, I was excited. So hearing about that, hearing the vision, that's when I decided, like, hey, listen, you know, I was really disappointed in the Ethereum community. You know, at the time, this was everyone else was jumping on board, getting all excited, but the only thing it could do was create token contracts and have these huge ICO, you know, lobby rallies, and it really was doing nothing. Like no one was getting on these applications. You know, the parents can't use this stuff still. No one's making any efforts into trying to actually further use of this other than the one use that it could be used in. It was getting bogged down. So knowing that anything else that was going to go on it, for me, it was like, all right, well, time to move on. I mean, when I was younger, when we were building the communication networks, and you had BBSs first, and then you had these the larger communities, like where you had things like Prodigy and CompuServe, right? And so you saw these networks come, but we're not still using Prodigy. It doesn't make any sense. No one's still firing up AOL. It's just not happening. So a lot of these networks will be like that. You know, you'll have these couple of year runs where we have these neat, interesting things. It might not be forever. Other new systems are going to come along and be, you know, faster, more efficient for different things. Now, myself, I believe that Bitcoin is the only currency. I also think that there is one of the privacy currencies is a currency as well. I don't know which team will win in those battles. But everything else, I mean, there's going to be millions. And after millions, there'll be billions of other cryptographic assets. And they're going to signify many different things. And if you classify, you know, for me, currency is a form of communication. And the only true digital currency might be Bitcoin, but there will be other ways to express your communication. So you will have this ownership of these community assets that I'm super excited about. And a lot of the other different things that will come out of this. But you know, EOS itself, for me, was a network that I knew you could start building applications on. That ideally, in the way that he was structuring his account permissions, that people could have some possibility of recovery and that they could use in a manner that wasn't going to be public key, private key infrastructure. So knowing that when he announced the secure enclave chip, I lost it. I knew immediately, like, we are on a path to mobile application, digital, you know, cryptographic asset use. And that's never happened before, right? We're really only 4 years deep onto these semi-turn complete networks. And this will be the first one that has true mobile forward use. And it's going to happen by, you know, December, January, February. We're going to get these mobile apps that people are going to start using day to day. And that's when we're going to start really driving adoption. So I got super excited about that. I was holding these EOS LA meetups. So I think last July, I kind of held my first, and then I had a big one in August. And a lot of the community around here, some of the Block One community is here. So we would have special guests for people to come see. And you know, I made them developer focused. I wanted to make sure that all the Ethereum group meetups and things like that that I have been going to, you know, the last couple of years, most of those were, you know, ICO focused. A lot of people lost sight of the developer community. And so that became something I would hark on and telling people when they walked in the door that if you're here to hear about prices, you're going to be super bored because I'm going to be here talking about technology the whole time.
Yeah. I agree, dude. So Liberty Block, when did that start?
I knew the idea of running Block production on this thing, you know, probably August, September is when I started thinking about it. Now on the Telegram chats, kind of this worldwide Telegram, the BP channels had started to pop up by that time. You're seeing a couple of the people that you still see here now do start testing and experimenting with stuff. And when that single-threaded application testnet came out, watching people pop around, do different things on that, now, I had a different kind of thought about how this would work. I mean, this is a politics game, and I haven't been someone who's so public, and I usually don't really care much about politics, but I knew that was the game we were going to be playing. So trying to figure out who I would align with during that was important. And really, the teams around here that were building interesting projects, we had just helped out the Everpedia crew in a lot of their relationships with Block One. So those guys are fantastic engineers. We had an EOS dev meetup that was going on. So during these dev meetups, I'd figure out, all right, you know, we were throwing up test nets for ourselves so we could start working on development for it, especially within Everpedia. And so getting a team together, I knew that would be helpful and be able to pull some of the politics is what we did. It took me a long time to announce. I really wasn't sure. I ran through different people that I was going to be working with and just trying to get an idea of how this would weigh out. A lot of people didn't know that our intentions were going to be there and we were going to go through this until the last little bit. But, you know, I had been following along and doing development work and understanding the system and teaching and creating this community the entire time. So the LA community knew this was coming. So we had a lot of deep voters. A lot of my constituents are here from the Los Angeles area. And so launched it and happy to do so. I mean, I think during the launch, I focused on security and worked on a couple of things to make sure that the network itself was going to be protected. You have a mixed bag of different people in the production community. I've been doing architecture, data center design all of my career professionally for banks and three-letter government organizations, and you have people that are, you know, planning on running these boxes off of Raspberry Pis in their home, you know. So it was a is one of those things that some people just don't have the understanding of true systems operation and architecture. So getting in, you know, we had a little group called Ghostbusters, and we kind of banded together and got on a lot of these Zoom calls to try to figure out how to make sure that this was going to be free from attack and make sure that, you know, when the software code was released, we were supposed to have a month with the final code before launching. You know, we wanted to be able to do some security reviews. And so Dan didn't finish the final code until the day we launched. And then he launched two or three other versions afterwards as we noticed issues during the time when we didn't get the we weren't ready for launch over that time. And there were a couple of things that I think were kind of some major hiccups that we wanted to get through. I'm glad we took the time to do it. So it was a lot of fun.
Oh, I love that. And how did you get to where you are now with Ikigai Asset Management? My mistake. So what was the story there?
Pushed
you over?
Yeah. So, you know, in the distributed network that we were all acting in, one of the things that I've recognized is that we didn't truly have institutionally compliant fund management, asset management. Now, that's not my history, but I got a lot of friends in that business. And one of them in particular, Travis Kling, he had been sniffing around the cryptographic asset world around the beginning of the summer. And he was calling me up and we were talking about different things. By December, he came out to visit me. He was working at Point 72. So Point 72 was one of the largest, most successful private hedge funds. It's run by a gentleman by the name of Steve Cohen. Yeah. The show Billions is based off of Steve Cohen. Yeah. And this guy's been one of the top asset managers in the world. Trav was working for him and managing money for him. And so, you know, Travis couldn't handle anything, paying attention to anything else other than crypto after about April or May. So he wanted to leave and he came out to talk to me. I knew this wasn't, you know, hadn't been solved yet. You know, the news was talking about how there were 300 crypto hedge funds formed and, you know, all these other people were claiming a lot of success, but I knew a lot of them and they were three crypto bros with a Trezor. And that's just not the way you manage institutional quality, you know, funds. So Travis, when he came down, he had just quit. He had just quit in December. He came out and what he originally wanted to do was go out to Africa and go on a volunteer mission as a do-gooder for a couple months. And I told him that if he wanted this opportunity, he stops what he's doing right now, moves out to Los Angeles, and we work on this. So he wasn't convinced yet. We went out to a couple conferences. The second conference we went to was Bitcoin Miami, and that was it's an absolute frenzy, and it was horrible. You know, it was just all these people who had no idea what they were doing, pumping the shit out of things that were just, you know, of zero quality. And he told me, "There's no way I'm getting into this. This is the Wild West. This is ridiculous." And I told him, "That's why we're doing this now. I mean, this is the Wild West. We're going to have issues here. You know, this market irrationality is not going to last. This is going to come crashing down and we're going to be ready to pounce." So he moved out to LA after February, early March. And we really started digging deep. And, you know, we have one of the most compliant infrastructures and one of, I think, the best infrastructure set for institutional capital. So we spent the last 6-7 months now with KPMG, Perkins Coie, a lot of the names that are family offices and the wealth funds will be familiar with and comfortable with. So we've been going around and, you know, we're not in this, and the intention isn't to be here to get rich people richer. You know, we've done this. We have Ikigai itself as a word. It's similar to a reason.
What's with the name? Like, where does that come from?
Yeah, it's a 1,200-year-old Japanese word. It's the center of what you love to do, what you're good at, what the world needs, and what you can get paid for, right? So this is your reason for being. And so when we came together and a couple of the other guys on our team, Anthony Entman, who's an incredibly ethical, amazing former captain in the Air Force, he is an incredible guy. And Christina Martin, she's our head of investor relations. We are here. We all believe ourselves to be shepherds of technology. So when we're out here and we're looking at different assets. We're strong in the asset class. So when we manage the liquid assets, liquid protocol assets, we are there to, you know, have and own more Bitcoin in either direction that it's going, making sure that we're able to collect more onto where the value rises in our own personal collection. But on the venture side, which is what I run, we are here to help enable technologies that will bring a better future for humanity. And so I feel so blessed to be able to do that and feel so blessed that we have the right, the partners that I surrounded myself with are all aligned in that ethical manner. You know, not here to get rich.
Can I ask you a serious question, Tim?
Yes, sir.
What scares you most about the crypto space at this current point in time?
What scares me most?
Yeah.
You know, probably regulation in only certain parts of the world. The lack of understanding what this stuff is, I think both on the engineer side from an outside perspective and from regulators is kind of a scary thing. You know, for a long time, Bitcoin was just magic internet drug money. And so that's a bad perception and the wrong perception. and regulators are quick to act about what this stuff is and not understand, you know, the implications for what it can have. Also, maybe not understanding, people a lot of times don't understand the differences between the benefits of Byzantine fault-tolerant distributed ledgers in permission networks as opposed to only benefits in decentralized networks, because it comes both ways and it'll happen in both types of systems. I mean, I dream about one fantasy world where we live in a completely decentralized, life, and we have all the only agreements that we assign to are the constitutions of the networks that we join. But that's not going to happen overnight. You know, we've got to get to these different positions. We've got to get to these different stages in the legal jurisdictions that we live around, to where these walls will come down. But it's going to happen gradually. And it's going to happen, you know, hopefully without war, hopefully without without fighting. So, you know, what scares me though is, you know, irrationality, people not understanding these things, and then regulators coming in to create blocks, right? So you're blocking the technology, right? So U.S. especially, and I really hope that there's participation and the possibility of participation for the younger engineers. Creating that freedom is what means everything, right? So being able to, if the growth of Ethereum really freed up so much of my time, allowed me to go through and do the things that I want to do without being beholden to someone who's telling me what I have to do, where I have to be. And so that's something that, you know, in the way that we have the separation of wealth in the world right now, I think that a lot of our, you know, most intelligent people aren't working on the things that drive and are passion, that they're passionate about, which means we're not getting some of the breakthrough works that we could be as humanity. And we're driven by this top-down capitalist infrastructure that, you know, really is only benefits the rich or those that were, you know, born rich. And so trying to, you know, if we don't have the possibility of getting to these new ways of creating value, being able to express value through your actions, being able to sit and benefit off of the things that you are developing and wherever you are in the world, that's what's going to be scary to me. But I think that we're just on the forefront of that. And if they stop it here in the U.S., people will move. You know, that's really only scares me for the U.S. Right. U.S. participants. I'm really excited for the rest of the world. You know, we've got you know, 8 billion people in the world. 6.8 billion are either underbanked or unbanked. 3.8 billion or so are unbanked completely. These people have not had any participation in a financial system, and they're about to get turned on, right? So it used to make me really sad. It used to make me really upset. You know, how many of the Einsteins of the world have we missed out on because we weren't connected to these people in the systems? Right. Now we're going to have these amazingly brilliant people from all over the world connecting to this internet and then being able to transfer value peer to peer over that network. And this is something that I've been stoked about and then thinking about my entire life, my entire career. And we are at a point now where it's happening. And so that's something I'm really excited about.
I love that, dude. Last question, man. Last question. Where does Tim Lewis see the future? Where is this going?
Man, seeing the future. I'm grateful that we have one. Hopefully we won't. destroy the environment first for our children. So you know, trying to figure out where those things are. Humanity mostly has looked at a future of what's 5 years ahead, what's 10 years ahead. You know, there are different communities that look at what's 50 years ahead, what's 100 years ahead. You know, we've had these things that have blocked our real moonshots. You know, we don't have space cars flying around Mars right now, and I blame religion. You know, once we have these open lines of communication and more people from a peer-to-peer perspective can communicate with each other, the possibilities are endless. We don't have to take information verbatim from some source of power. We can decide for ourselves what reputation and what is right, and we can have science to back that up. So I see this, we're about to hit this hockey stick, man. All these technologies are coming together right now. You know, the network that we have right now allows us all to communicate. The cryptographic systems that we have are going to be able to place reputation and value and peer-to-peer exchange over this network to where we can actually have trust. Once we can do that, science will just catapult, and the ability for people to transfer ideas all across the world from any part of the world to any other without restriction and without scare or fear of danger that could have come that people in some areas of the world operating in science might have felt if they felt that their communications were being monitored. So we can have all these new scientists, all these other people with radical ideas collaborating together. So we're going to see this next decade of ours is going to be the largest decade of growth in mankind. I think this next 10 to 20 years, we're going to have such a radical change in science, in economy, and in the world that this is the most exciting time to be alive. Now, I used to worry about living in another generation, that maybe I missed out on the gold rush, or I wanted to be in the roaring 20s. This is the sweep of the roaring 20s. It's going to be back. It's going to be bigger. We're going to have some really amazing stuff. You know, robotics is coming. You know, the replicant consciousness is coming. You know, we're going to be doing these crazy things that we never thought possible. You know, neural mesh turning on, you know, us in this consciousness together is just going to be super exciting, Charles. So
I love that.
Up in a way.
And by the way, is there anything while we have you on the show that you'd like to say to the SVK crypto community listening?
You know, SVK crypto community is rad. I love seeing all of the different crypto communities that are and have popped up worldwide. One of my favorite gentlemen in the world, a Burning Man campmate member of mine, is from London, who happens to be here in town right now, and he's been very turned on to the London community. Things that you guys are doing are great. Thank you guys always for welcoming us. You guys are welcome anytime out here in LA.
Likewise,
vote brother. For Liberty Black. We need to continue to do good things in the EOS community. Excited for the EOS San Francisco Hackathon. We're going to be hosting a boot camp on the 8th and the 9th for Solidity developers. If you have any questions about it, pop over to our Liberty Black Telegram channel. We'll start talking about it over there. But thank you, SVK Crypto. Keep doing a good job. Great work, Charles. Shout out to Shane. I appreciate you guys.
Listen, man, nothing but love from our side, dude. You're welcome to London anytime and to any of our events. I know you enjoyed the last one.
Well, sounds good.
I want to say a big thank you to Mr. Timothy Lewis for making it on the show today. We really appreciate your time. And we really appreciate your insight. I also want to thank you, the listener, for tuning in and being part of something special that is the 15 Minutes of Crypto Fame podcast. And remember, as always, hit us up on our social channels, Telegram, which is SVK Crowd. If you type that into Telegram, you'll find us. My email is cstory, C-S-T-O-R-R-Y, at svkcrypto.com. If you have any projects where you want to reach out, feel free and hit us up on Twitter at svk_crypto. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your attention. That's a wrap.
You've been listening to an SVK Crypto Podcast original. Follow us on Twitter at SVK_crypto. email us on cstory@svkcrypto.com. Leave us a message on our website, www.svkcrypto.com.